For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Pillar Podcast, hosted by myself, David, and my co-host, Craig. Thanks for joining us this week as we continue covering the trial of Richard Allen for the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German. How's it going, Craig?
It is going well. How are you doing, sir?
I am good. Before we dive into the coverage of the case, I just wanted to point the listeners out to our website, killerpodcast.org. There we'll be posting the shows, linked directly out to Spotify if that's your platform of choice. You can also find our Patreon there, and signing up for that will get you some ad-free episodes as well as early listens to certain exclusive content. We'd appreciate it if you go jump out to the site and sign up for our Patreon. Much appreciated. You can also find our social media links there as well. But Craig, do you want to tell these fine folks where they can find us?
Yes, we are on X at @killer_podcast, Instagram at @killer_podcast, and we also have a Facebook page out there. I believe it is Killer Podcast as well. So if you would, please go out there, like, subscribe, do all that fun social media stuff, and help us out.
Yes, sir.
All right, you ready to kick things off?
I am. Let's do it.
You are listening to Killer, and this is Delphi, the trial of Richard Allen.
Lock your doors, bolt your windows, and turn off the lights. We're about to begin.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to our coverage of the Delphi murders, the trial of Richard Allen. We're going to kick off with day 12 of the trial there. Thursday, October 31st, 2024. So this was a pivotal day in the trial of Richard Allen. He was accused of the 2017 murders of Abby Williams and Libby German, as you all know. The prosecution rested its case, and they concluded with testimony that could leave a lasting impression on the jury.
That's right, David. The day started with the state calling its final witness, Brian Harshman, a master trooper who analyzed over 700 recorded phone calls involving Allen. His job? To monitor Allen's communications and behavior while in custody.
And Harshman's testimony was significant. He stated, in his expert opinion, that the voice of the so-called bridge guy heard on the video taken by Libby German is the voice of Richard Allen.
That moment in court was intense. The prosecution played the chilling video again, those haunting words, down the hill. Then came the direct question, whose voice was that? Harshman's answer, Richard Allen.
Yeah, and for those who want to hear the audio one more time, if you haven't already heard it a million times, we'll play it for you now. But it wasn't just that. The jury also heard recorded phone calls where Allen appeared to wrestle with guilt, confusion, and severe distress.
The call from November 14th, 2022 was particularly emotional. In it, Allen, speaking to his wife, Kathy, seemed to be at a breaking point. He told her he was willing to tell investigators whatever they want. He was crying, saying he wished he could see her one last time, and even talked about taking his own life.
Fast forward to April 2nd of 2023, when he spoke with his mother, Janice. That conversation was different. He was emotional, but focused on faith, telling her that he had turned his life to Christ just weeks earlier. But the most shocking call came the very next day.
April 3rd, 2023. In a phone call to Kathy, Allen made a stunning statement. I did it. I killed Abby and Libby.
Kathy's response? Immediate disbelief. No, you didn't, she insisted. Allen, however, doubling down, repeated, I think I did.
But then he wavered, adding, maybe I think I did. I don't know. Kathy pushed back, suggesting his mind was being manipulated, that he wasn't thinking clearly.
That wasn't the only time Alan made similar statements. In multiple conversations, he said that he was losing his mind and he wanted Kathy to understand that he did it, but then also admitted that he didn't even know what was real.
It's a disturbing and complex picture, but after these bombshell recordings, the prosecution rested its case. The defense then had its turn, though their first two witnesses didn't provide much new insight.
First up was Cheyenne Mill, who was on the trails the day that the girls disappeared, and she described seeing a man who was overweight and didn't speak when she greeted him. She also took photos that day and shared them with investigators.
The second witness, Teresa Liebert, testified about seeing a strange man standing near mailboxes, but she couldn't describe his face or clothing. The prosecution wasted no time in pointing out the limitations of her testimony.
And the jury had questions too. They wanted to confirm that there was no school that day and asked if the man by the mailboxes could have been a student. Liebert said no.
And with that, the defense began their case. But after a day filled with emotional testimony, recorded confessions, and expert analysis, one thing is certain. This jury has a lot to consider.
Yeah, that's right. And moving on to day 13 of the murder trial, which was on Friday, November 1st, the defense finally had its chance to present witnesses, but by the end of the session, all anyone could talk about was Judge Fran Gull's ruling.
The judge shot down a second defense motion to allow testimony related to Odinism, ritualistic killing, and Norse paganism. The defense wanted this to be part of their argument, but the judge wasn't having it.
And with that, the defense called their first witness of the day, Officer Christopher Goody from the Hammond Police Department. He was also part of the FBI's Gang Response Investigative Task Force and helped with canvas interviews during the Delphi investigation.
Goody specifically recalled interviewing Brad Weber, who lived near the Monenheim Bridge. His private driveway actually passes under it. Weber said he went home after work on February 13, 2017, the day Abby Williams and Libby German disappeared. But when asked if he wrote the report on that interview, Goody admitted he didn't. FBI Special Agent Adam Pohl did.
And when the defense pressed him on what Weber had actually told him, Goody simply couldn't remember, even after looking at the report. No cross-examination from the prosecution, no jury questions.
The second witness was Dr. Deanna DeWanger, a clinical psychologist and director of behavioral health at the Indiana Department of Corrections. She had some eye-opening testimony about Richard Allen's treatment in prison.
She stated that she had no role in determining which facility Allen was sent to, nor did she know who made that decision, but she did confirm that he wasn't housed in a mental health unit.
And here's where things get interesting. DeWanger revealed that Dr. Monica Walla, who previously testified for the prosecution, had actually told her she was a true crime fan and listened to Delphi-related podcasts. That was before she ever treated Allen.
Yeah, and that's a big red flag. DeWanger also said that she knew Dr. Walla had visited the Monenheim Bridge before Allen ever arrived at the Westville facility. On top of that, she testified that Allen was constantly on camera in his cell, something she said was a major concern for his mental health.
She even recommended those cameras be removed, but that never happened. And speaking of mental health, DeWanger stated that Allen was diagnosed with a serious mental illness, or SMI, and yet spent 13 months in solitary confinement. According to DOC policy, someone with SMI shouldn't be in solitary for more than 30 days.
And that's a huge violation. When cross-examined, Prosecutor Stacy Diener asked when exactly Allen was diagnosed. DeWanger clarified that while he wasn't diagnosed upon arrival, his condition noticeably declined by April of 2023. And that's when a mental health team debated whether he was faking it or genuinely psychotic.
Ultimately, they concluded he was in a grave disability state and involuntarily gave him Haldol, an antipsychotic medication. The jury had questions, too, specifically about how doctors differentiate between real and faked psychosis.
DeWanger explained that organized storytelling suggests faking, while disorganized, non-chronological thoughts indicate real psychosis. But when the defense tried to dig deeper on redirect, the prosecution objected to every single question, and Judge Gall sustained them all.
Then came Max Baker, a defense team member who curated prison footage of Richard Allen. The defense wanted to submit videos of Allen in his cell and during transport. But here's the twist. Judge Gall ruled the video was admissible, but not the audio. Since Allen isn't testifying, she said the audio would be hearsay.
And because some technical issues, Baker was recessed as a witness. So for now, the video evidence is on hold. After lunch, the defense brought in Brad Heath, a retired exterminator who was near the Monanhai Bridge on February 13, 2017.
Heath testified that he saw an older, dark blue vehicle parked near the CPS building around 8:45 a.m. When he returned later that day, the car was still there. He described it as looking like something out of a Tommy Lee Jones movie.
He told the police about it a week later, thinking it might be useful. No cross-examination. No jury questions. Just his testimony standing alone.
Then came David McCain, a project manager for the trail system. He was on the bridge that afternoon, taking photos and enjoying the nice weather. But here's where it gets crucial. He heard a man shouting, "Have you seen two girls?"
That's a chilling detail. McCain wasn't sure exactly what time he was there. He estimated between 2:30 and 3:15 p.m. The prosecution confronted him with FBI notes, and he admitted that the man shouting sounded genuinely concerned.
After that, the defense brought in Daryl Sterrett, former chief of the Delphi Fire Department. He recalled coordinating search efforts on February 13, 2017. His team searched until 2:30 a.m. the next morning, concentrating on the south and west portions of the trails.
He described it as a hasty search, covering ground quickly, assuming the girls were scared and hiding. He noted some civilians helped, and though searchers looked in the creek, he couldn't say if they looked deeply enough.
The final witness of the day was Steve Mullen, an investigator for the Carroll County Prosecutor's Office. Defense attorney Andrew Baldwin hammered him on evidence preservation, or rather, the lack of it.
Yeah, Mullen admitted that dozens of taped interviews were recorded over or lost forever. Another batch of interviews recorded between April and June was wiped out when a DVR was accidentally reformatted, and the video was partially recovered, but all of the audio was gone.
And when asked if the people in those interviews were re-questioned, Mullen said some were, but he had no idea which ones. That's a major problem.
And with that, day 13 came to an end. The defense made some headway, but between lost evidence and mental health concerns and the Odinism ruling, the trial is far from over. So what did you think so far from the defense's initial strategy?
We've discussed the Odinism thing, you know, quite a bit in the last few recordings, and, you know, not entirely surprised that it was thrown out because it kind of sounded like a radical idea when I first heard of it. So not surprised by that. And another thing that caught my eye here is, how does a DVR accidentally get reformatted? I mean, seriously, come on. You have to go, anything that you reformat or factory reset, you have to go through so much stuff to get to that point.
Yeah, I mean, who knows for sure? It could just simply be that there was a hard drive sitting around and no one knew what was on it, didn't check it, reformatted it and used it, or it was mislabeled. You know what I mean? Just incompetence, right?
Right.
And that's the dangerous part of the time gap in a lot of cases. Is that time gap happens and a lot of things can be destroyed, lost, and ruined. It happens all the time. And so, you know, that evidence is crucial. So the quicker you can get to conviction or find your suspect, the better. But in this case, luckily, they still found and apprehended a suspect. But you never know what's going to happen there.
Yeah. And what did you think about Judge Gull ruling that the video from the prison cell could be watched, but the audio had to be muted out? I mean, you could use video to watch mannerisms and behaviors, but what did you think of that piece?
I'm not sure how I feel about that, honestly. If Alan isn't testifying, but he's on video all the time, and he's in a security facility, like, what's the difference? I don't know. Like, why are they videoing him the whole time then if they can't use that in a court of law?
Yeah.
It seems a little odd.
Well, I'm assuming they're recording him and keeping an eye on him because, you know, he went through several different statuses of suicide watch as he was under evaluation. So, I mean, for safety reasons, they were probably recording him 24/7 just to watch him. But, you know,
I mean, that's true. But at the same time, they saved all the recordings, you know?
True.
They could have just overrode him after, you know, 72 hours or whatever. It's like, yeah, he's still alive today, you know?
Right.
Because obviously they're monitoring him to make sure he's not hurting himself. And then somebody, if they're not next to his cell, you know, is watching, hopefully, the monitors and can go stop anything from happening. That kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm assuming, you know, she's a judge, right? She knows way more than I do. I would assume that there is definitely some legal reason why they can't present that evidence.
Right. Well, I mean, we talked about some of his behavior in the last episode, too. So, I mean, there's still depending on what they're capturing on video, if they're capturing, you know, every minute of every day, and some of the stuff we talked about in the last episode was pretty disgusting. So, I mean, the jury could make some assumptions based on that if they're sitting there watching video and this guy's shitting and pissing all over himself. I mean, who in their right mind is going to do that? I mean, it automatically puts some kind of perception into their thinking, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on to day 14 of the trial, which took place on Saturday, November 2nd, 2024.
The day started with a significant ruling from Judge Fran Gall on whether to admit camcorder videos of Allen taken while he was incarcerated at Westville Correctional Facility. The prosecution objected due to the explicit nature of the videos, but the defense argued they should be played for jurors only, citing the dignity of those involved.
In the end, Judge Gall ruled in favor of admitting the videos despite the prosecution's objections. These videos, taken between April and May of 2023, were compiled by Max Baker, who returned to the stand today after first testifying on Friday.
The defense played 15 videos for the jury, many showing Allen with his arms restrained behind his back, often accompanied by guards in what looked like a cell or corridor. Four of the videos showed Allen completely naked.
The videos increased in length, with one reaching nearly 30 minutes and the final one lasting a staggering 52 minutes. Jurors took notes and were visibly tense, some even cringing. Defense attorney Jennifer Auger was reportedly staring in horror at one point.
Notably absent from the courtroom was Allen's wife, Kathy Allen. Given the nature of these videos, speculation suggests she may not have wanted to witness them.
The prosecution chose not to cross-examine Baker today, and with that, the court adjourned just before noon.
After a weekend break, the trial resumed on Monday with expert testimony from Dr. Polly Westcott, a neuropsychologist brought in by the defense. Dr. Westcott, who charges $400 per hour for forensic work, evaluated Allen's mental state.
She testified that Allen had long suffered from anxiety and depression, dating back to childhood, and according to her, Allen had an intense fear of school, worried about his family's well-being, and was deeply concerned with how others perceived him.
Her assessment led her to diagnose Allen with dependent personality disorder, meaning he relied heavily on others, primarily his wife Kathy, and sometimes his mother, to function in daily life. She also testified that Allen had experienced episodes of psychosis while in prison.
Interestingly, she stated that Allen did not appear to be exaggerating his symptoms and had significantly deteriorated while in custody. She also challenged the accuracy of the state's expert, Dr. Walla, suggesting their report may have misconstrued Allen's state of mind.
The jury was actively engaged, submitting 8 questions for Dr. Westcott. One notable question asked if childhood anxiety and depression could lead someone to commit a crime later in life. Dr. Westcott's response? Highly unlikely in Allen's case, as he was more passive and submissive than aggressive.
Next up, Max Baker returned to the stand, and he testified that he reviewed over 200 hours of footage of Allen in Westville Correctional Facility, condensing it to about 2 hours for the court. Some of the footage depicted disturbing behavior included Allen eating his own feces and banging his head against the cell wall.
The jury's reaction was mixed. One male juror, who previously struggled with graphic autopsy photos, had a hard time watching. However, overall, the jurors seemed less shocked compared to Saturday.
A key point of contention came during cross-examination. Prosecutor Nicholas McClelland accused Baker of portraying Allen in a sympathetic light, selecting footage that framed him as a victim.
McClelland pressed Baker, stating, "Richard Allen is not the victim in this case, is he?" Baker firmly responded, "No."
The jury did pose one question to Baker, whether the defense had instructed him on which clips to use. Baker stated that he had full discretion.
Monday afternoon saw testimony from additional witnesses, including two who had already taken the stand earlier in the trial.
One of them, Steve Mullen, who was recalled to clarify his findings on the number of Ford Focus vehicles in Carroll County. Meanwhile, Brad Weber, a local resident, returned to the stand after becoming frustrated with the defense's questioning last week.
Weber recounted his interactions with law enforcement on February 13, 2017, when authorities asked if he had seen Abby and Libby on the trails. He said no. He also noted that while he granted permission for police to search his outbuildings, they did not do so during their initial visit.
The final witnesses of the day were Allen's sister, Jamie Jones, and his daughter, Brittany Zapanta. The defense asked both women if Allen had ever molested them, to which they firmly responded, no. This contradicted a statement Allen had made to a prison mental health worker where he claimed he may have molested his sister.
The defense asked both women if they loved Allen. They each responded with a heartfelt yes. They also affirmed they would never lie to protect him.
The prosecution's cross-examination was brief but pointed. Attorney James Luttrell asked Zapanta whether Allen's appearance had significantly changed over the years. She said it had not.
When asked if she had ever visited the Monon High Bridge trails with her father, she confirmed that she had. In a poignant moment, Allen and his daughter locked eyes in the courtroom, and she smiled at him despite the gravity of the situation.
Yeah, and that was kind of a wrap for day 15. And, you know, it was kind of interesting to see the defense's strategy here. Obviously, they're trying to play the sympathy card by showing Allen's treatment in prison and how he was feeling. You know, they're going after that pretty hard, but still tough to say whether or not that has any effect on the jury here.
Yeah, well, it obviously had some effect on the one juror who, I mean, it stated that he was kind of visibly shaken by some of the autopsy photos from the day before, but in turn less shocked at what he was watching in the courtroom that day, you know, with Allen being marched around naked and some of the stuff he was doing in his cell.
Right. And they also brought Steve Mullen back to testify about the Ford Focuses, and I think we talked about this last week a little bit. The number of Ford Focus vehicles in Carroll County was important because they were trying to figure out if the prosecution keying in on that Ford Focus that was parked near the crime scene that they found on video, if that could indeed match Allen. And they're trying to paint the picture that there's more Ford Focuses than you let on, kind of thing, and poke a hole in their efforts to put him at that scene, right? And they're trying to say, there are more Ford Focuses around here than what you can say. You can't even nail this down to the trim. You don't know what it is from the videos that you have. You just know there's a black Ford Focus. You know that Richard Allen has a black Ford Focus, but you don't know how many more are in this area. You can't definitively say it's him. You don't have the license plate number. So they're trying to really poke a hole in the prosecution's evidence there, trying to put him at the scene.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, rightfully so. I think I alluded to this earlier on in this case. You know, Ford Focus is a pretty common car, you know, and we determined that it was a little bit more specific at a trim level and this and that, but when it comes right down to it, we don't have a license plate image. You know, that's the glaring gap in what the defense is trying to point out.
Right, and I think it's a great strategy by them. They should be poking a hole in that and making sure that the facts are truly the facts, right? And they shouldn't be allowing the prosecution to just throw things out there like this, being generally vague about it. So it is good that they did that, I think.
Yeah. And one thing before we move on to day 16 too, there was a question that came up in the line of questioning asking if Allen's appearance had changed over the years. And I found that interesting because as I've been looking through information and watching different videos and still images on the internet, did you notice that how much he visibly changed from the time of his arrest photo and his mugshot until, you know, it gets a little bit later on in the case? I mean, it looks like the guy lost 60 pounds and he's withering away to nothing from the time he was arrested until we get up to the trial. I mean, I thought that was a strange statement saying his appearance hadn't changed, because to me it visibly had while he was in custody.
Yeah, I think the focus of that was pre-arrest. So to your point, yeah, after he was arrested, he did change his appearance dramatically. His hair got grayer, he got thinner. You know, he looks way worse off than he did when he was originally arrested and in his, you know, mugshots and stuff like that. Very similar to Golden State Killer. I don't know if you remember that, but when they arrested Joseph James D'Angelo, he was like pretty husky, I would say. You know, he wasn't shy on the calories, I would say.
Right.
And then when they went to trial, he looked like a gaunt, frail old man.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, from the D'Angelo case, he didn't get to eat that pot roast he had put in the oven before he got hauled off to jail, so.
That's right.
He was lacking some protein.
Three hots and a cot, man. Three hots and a cot. That's all you get.
No more Bojangles.
Yeah, that's right. So let's move on to day 16.
One of the first witnesses to take the stand was Betsy Blair. She had already testified earlier in the trial, but today she was back to talk about what she saw near the Monon High Bridge on February 13th, 2017.
That was the day Abby and Libby were last seen alive. Blair said that she remembered seeing a car near the trails parked at the CPS building. What stood out to her was the way it was positioned, turned, and backed into a spot. She found that unusual.
She also described the car, saying it reminded her of her father's 1965 Ford Comet. She noted it was not a bright color, likely something darker.
Then the defense called their own expert witness, Dr. Stuart Grassian, a psychiatrist. His testimony focused on Richard Allen's mental health, specifically how solitary confinement can cause cognitive impairment.
He claimed Allen was showing symptoms of delirium and memory loss, saying Allen himself was afraid he couldn't remember things. Dr. Grassian argued that solitary confinement can have lasting effects on memory and mental clarity.
Next up, Dr. Eric Warren, a forensic examiner for the defense, took the stand. His testimony was all about the single .40 caliber cartridge that was found at the crime scene.
And that's a crucial piece of evidence. Earlier in the trial, Dr. Melissa Oberg testified for the prosecution, saying that the bullet had been cycled through Allen's Sig Sauer .40 caliber pistol. Warren, however, disagreed with her findings.
He reviewed Oberg's work and photographs of the bullet, but did not examine the gun or the cartridge himself. He argued there wasn't enough agreement between the bullet fired from Allen's gun and the unspent cartridge at the scene.
He also criticized Oberg's methodology, saying she couldn't have compared a spent casing to an unspent round.
The defense then brought in another forensic examiner, Stacy Eltbridge, who had analyzed data from Liberty German's phone. One of the more surprising revelations in her testimony was about the phone's headphone jack.
She said data indicated that at 5:45 p.m. on February 13th, a headphone was plugged into the phone's audio jack and remained there for nearly 5 hours. That happened just seconds after the phone received a call.
The prosecution countered the argument with two Indiana State Police forensic examiners. One, Sergeant Christopher Cecil, pointed out that water damage or dirt could make the phone register that something was plugged in, according to a quick Google search he conducted.
The defense wasn't happy with that response. They argued that relying on a Google search in court wasn't exactly a solid foundation.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about this headphone jack piece. This seemed to actually carry a lot of weight and significant time during this day of the trial. The interesting part of it is that, to their point, they're trying to testify that something was plugged into the headphone jack at 5:45 p.m. and lasted until the phone powered off. I think that was only 10:30 p.m. around there. There's no way there was a headphone plugged into this phone. It just didn't happen. This is just bullshit, in my opinion.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Yeah, well, from a forensic standpoint, too, okay, it registers that a headphone has been plugged in, but I would think when you're tracking down the data and the analysis of the phone, you're going to look to see, well, if a headphone was plugged in, did someone play music? Did someone make a call? Did someone log on to a social media site to listen to audio? You know, whatever. Just the fact that it says that the phone was plugged into a headphone jack for nearly 5 hours. I mean, to me, it's pretty clear that it was probably some kind of debris or water had gotten into the port.
100%. You and I work in technology. We deal with this stuff all the time. Technology does stupid things all the time. And water is the enemy of tech. Like, you know that. It's going to cause major problems whenever those two things are mixed, especially this version of phone. Nowadays, a lot of phones, almost all phones, are basically waterproof, mm-hmm. up to a point. This phone was like an iPhone 6S or something, or iPhone 6. It's older. It's not built the same way. So just remember that when you're thinking about this and wondering, well, could this have been waterproof? It had to be headphones. Well, no, that's not the case. And on top of that, this just, it just, the phone was found underneath the girl's body.
Right.
So, and by this time, it's 5:45 p.m., there's a search happening for the girls. You would have to imagine that whomever had murdered them was long gone by now. They don't want to stick around. They're not going to hang out around the crime scene and plug stuff into their phones. They're also not going to take the phone, leave, and come back. If they did, the cell phone data would point to the cell phone pinging on different cell phone towers. It clearly did not, because we know that the phone got phone calls and text messages right before it powered off, and it was in this location. So there's so many like random things that had happened around this that never brought up in this whole line of questioning, which really frustrated me, because I'm sitting here going, there's 80 million reasons why this phone just had debris or water in it. It's that simple. It is that simple. A Google search did solve this problem. It solves a lot of problems, yeah. Quite frankly.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And not to go down the nerdy trail here too far, but I believe the iPhones started the waterproofing technology with the iPhone 7. And the reason I remember that is when the iPhone 7 came out, we got our son a brand new iPhone 7. Went on vacation, he took it for a swim in his pocket, and thank God it was waterproof. So...
I thought you were going to tell me he dropped it in the toilet and he had to recover it.
No, I'll leave that to my wife and daughter, dropping phones in the toilet.
Yeah. So let's move on to day 17, which was Wednesday, November 6th, 2024.
Big developments today, David. The defense officially rested its case in the Richard Allen trial.
That's right. After presenting expert witnesses over the past several days, including psychiatrists, forensic specialists, and evidence analysis, the defense wrapped up its arguments.
Judge Fran Gall was a little surprised. She said, "I wasn't anticipating having this conversation quite yet," but she quickly moved on to discuss jury instructions and argument timing with both sides.
Each side will get 2 to 2.5 hours for their closing arguments, but before that, the prosecution began their rebuttal, starting with Breanne Wilbur.
Wilbur had already testified earlier in the trial. She was on the Monon High Bridge the day Abby and Libby disappeared. This time, she was asked about Snapchat photos she took at the Freedom Bridge, time-stamped 12:25 p.m.
The defense tried to poke holes in her memory, questioning whether investigators focused on certain parts of her day. Wilbur said they primarily concentrated on the later parts.
Another rebuttal witness was Brian Harshman, a master trooper with Indiana State Police. He talked about the conditions Richard Allen faced in prison.
The defense had claimed that Allen's solitary confinement conditions were inhumane, but Harshman argued that the conditions were similar across different facilities where Allen was housed.
The final rebuttal witness was Dr. John Martin, a psychiatrist with over 40 years of experience. He was the one who administered Haldol to Allen while he was in prison.
His testimony focused on the distinction between solitary confinement and being housed in a one-man cell. He said Allen hadn't broken any prison rules, but was still kept isolated, likely as a protective measure.
He also described a crucial moment on April 13, 2023, when he was called to Allen's cell. Allen was naked, had feces smeared on his body, and was in a highly disturbed state.
That led to an emergency meeting with mental health staff, where they decided to medicate Allen involuntarily. He was given short-acting Haldol for a few days before receiving a long-acting dose on April 18th.
Over time, Dr. Martin testified that Allen's condition improved, and by May 2, 2023, he showed no signs of psychosis. However, the defense questioned Martin's qualifications and past work history.
That led to a tense exchange. The defense brought up Martin's termination from a job in Florida, but the judge didn't allow further questioning on that topic.
The most dramatic moment came when the defense played a video of Allen on June 20, 2023. He appeared catatonic, barely moving. That was the same day Dr. Martin had said Allen was fully oriented and clear-headed.
The jury clearly took note of that. They asked multiple questions, including whether Allen could have been faking his symptoms in the video. And Dr. Martin said, "I don't think so."
Another juror asked if someone could slip in and out of psychosis within a 24-hour period. Dr. Martin said yes.
And with that, the evidence phase of the trial came to a close. Judge Gall dismissed the jury early, so the attorneys could prepare their closing arguments, which would begin the following day. I do want to talk about something that we had mentioned in a previous episode, which was the leaks of the crime scene photos and what had gone on there. And first, I would like to play a clip of one of the defense attorneys talking through the leaks themselves and then talk about this a little bit afterwards. Take a listen.
On October the 9th, I believe, a Monday afternoon, about 4 o'clock, he came in, he called me and he said, "Hey, I really got to talk to you." And it was one of those things where it almost sounded like he's, you know, he might have cancer or he something might be going on with him, because I was like, I'm leaving. No, stay there. And then he came in and he said, "You know, I got to tell you that I had," he knew that I was upset because somebody was asserting that the defense had leaked out photographs. And I was so angry about that. And I had emailed Judge Gall and said, "I want to find out who this is just as much as anybody." And Mitch came in, he said it was me, because I took you were in your office, which is right next door, and the door was shut, and I was waiting on you. Then I wandered in here and took these photos, and then, you know, I made the biggest mistake of my life, and I shared it with this guy, and then he sent it to this guy in Texas. And I just sat there stunned, and I just said, you know, they're going to blame me, and they're gonna, you know, already that was after the Franks memo had come out, and everybody's upset at me, you know, and you know, there had been contentious depositions with Jerry Holman and others, and I knew that, I just instantly knew they're going to use this as a springboard to try to get me off the case or something. And I told Mitch that. I said, "You're probably going to need to get a lawyer." And that's what happened. You know, he didn't come in here and burglarize the place. That's what some rumor is, that he came in here and did that. That is not what happened. I mean, ultimately, and I've said this in a couple of other media appearances, I have forgiven Mitch because, you know, I'm a Christian, and I, you know, that's in my nature to do. And I want, he has suffered tremendously because of this. And he is a human being. And, you know, the fallout from it for everybody is awful. The family itself, I mean, I have to sit here and did I get upset and cry about the thought that those photos are out there? I can get upset about it as we speak right now, okay? And people say, "Oh, that's just you doing it for the camera or whatever," but it is not. Anybody that knows me would know that, anybody. And so, you know, it's upsetting to me that that would be attributed to me, and it's also upsetting to me that it's attributable to Mitch, that he had was somebody that said, "Oh, he was working with the prosecution." That is also ridiculous. You know, there is a theory out there that there is some connectivity between the gentleman that did leak them from Texas, and there's a line back to Nick McClelland, because there was some evidence out there that we presented at the contempt hearing on March 18th that Nick was interacting with some podcast or YouTube guy. And I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not saying Nick, you know, reverse engineered this thing and got this guy to get this guy to talk to Mitch, his friend, because he knew that it was me. I'm not saying that, but it was never investigated. You know, I don't know exactly how or why it happened, and it is super upsetting. And I don't even like talking about it, but I just feel that it has to be talked about. And people will say, you're protecting, you're saying nice things about Mitch because, you know, he's saying that, you know, he's protecting you or something. That's just not the case. You know, it just isn't the case. It was a awful, life-altering mistake, and he is suffering big time for it. And, you know, part of it is deserved, I suppose, because he set into action, you know, a chain of events that, you know, ultimately could have even cost Richard Allen his freedom, I suppose, depending on what the jury may have known ahead of time. I don't know. But, you know, I want people to lay off of him because, you know, he's suffering right now. And the family has suffered. And again, well, then you're not thinking about the family. I am thinking about the family. I've been thinking about the family. So I'm sorry for ranting like that, but it's you know, that was something that resulted in me getting kicked off the case. That resulted in me going into some deep despair. I was curled up in a fetal ball, literally for days after that all happened. And then Jerry Holman got involved, and he should not have been involved in the investigation of the leaks. I mean, it's just common sense. It has to be in their book of, you know, proper protocol that when I'm in a case with you and I've been, you know, we're going after the investigation hard, there's 3,000 or whatever state troopers out there. Why does he have to get involved in this case? Why? It should have been local police down here in Franklin, Indiana, not, you know, some guy from the state police post. It's ridiculous. But that's how badly he wanted us off the case. And that's my opinion. I think Jerry Holman intentionally did everything that he did. He went up and talked to the gentleman that's, you know, awfully, sadly, you know, is no longer with us. And, you know, he lied to him. And he said, you know, basically, I can throw you in jail. I can call the judge. I've got her phone number right now. And it wasn't very long afterward that the gentleman, you know, did what he did. And that needs to be looked into, by the way. Nobody's looked into that. There's audio tape of that that is out there. This is all presented at the March 18th hearing. It was talked about at the March 18th contempt hearing. So thank you for letting me.
So as you heard from Andrew Baldwin, one of Richard Allen's defense attorneys, the leaks of those crime scene photos had some catastrophic impact. You know, obviously, we almost lost those attorneys to the case. They almost got kicked off completely. They ended up coming back, as we already covered. But what I wanted to point out was Mitch Westerman was the person who leaked those photos, and he was arrested and sentenced. And I believe he's actually been let out by now. But the person that he shared the photos to, I couldn't track down a name for, but that person then committed suicide. And that person had shared those photos with the podcasters and true crime community and started disseminating them across the internet. I just wanted to bring that up because I know we've talked about it a little bit, and that was something that I felt like was kind of interesting. What was your opinion of Andrew Baldwin after listening to that clip?
I get the point he was trying to make when he was kind of appealing to back off of Mitch Westerman, said he suffered enough, but that's for me, that's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah, okay, he made a mistake. Things happened. This guy ends up killing himself because he's stuck in the middle of this huge conspiracy about leaking all these photos to all these different platforms. But come right down to it, it was illegal what he did. You know, how much sympathy should we show? These families waited 5+ years to get to this point. And like he said, it could have resulted in the freedom of Richard Allen. And to Baldwin's point, I mean, that's obviously what he's fighting for, but that's not, you know, when we come to the resolution of this case, that's not what we're looking to put the person who killed these little girls behind bars with no loopholes or strings attached.
Right. I sort of felt like he's a little disingenuous. If I'm honest, I don't know that, but it's a sense that I get in listening to the audio. He just, you know, said he was curled up in a ball for literal days. I don't believe that for one second.
Nah, I would have asked for proof of that. Show us, yeah. Show us your Oscar performance.
Yeah, to me it was a little disingenuous. I know that a lot of people online back the defense and feel a certain way about this, but I just didn't. I don't know. Something rubs me the wrong way. I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I don't buy it either. He's definitely a good defense attorney. Let me put it that way. It kind of felt to me like just listening to that audio, he's kind of talking out of both sides of his mouth, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it did. So let's move on to day 18, which was Thursday, November 7th. This was the closing arguments. And after weeks of testimony, the prosecution and defense have made their final cases. So let's break it down.
That's right, David. The prosecution kicked things off, taking just under an hour to summarize their case. Prosecuting attorney Nicholas McClelland began his argument at 9:22 a.m., reminding the jury that February 13, 2017 is a day this community will never forget, the day Abigail Williams and Liberty German were murdered.
The prosecution presented a chilling timeline, starting with the photos of the girls on the trail that day. They highlighted key evidence, the video captured on Liberty's phone at 2:13, showing the moment that they believe the girls were kidnapped. McClelland told the jury, something told Liberty to record this.
Jurors were also shown an enhanced version of that video. Betsy Blair, a prosecution witness, testified that she saw Bridge Guy on the first platform around 2 p.m., looking as though he was searching for someone. She even passed Abby and Libby on the trail.
And although the witnesses described the man slightly differently, McClelland emphasized that they all agreed he was Bridge Guy. The prosecution's argument was simple. Identify Bridge Guy, and you identify the killer.
They connected Bridge Guy to a 2016 Ford Focus seen in surveillance footage, the only one registered in Carroll County at the time, and it belonged to Richard Allen. They pointed to inconsistencies in Allen's statements. In 2017, he told police he was on the trails at 1:30 p.m., but in 2023, he claimed it was 12:30 p.m. Then they detailed Allen's increasingly defensive behavior, including his refusal to let police search his phone or home.
And when they did search his home, what did they find? A jacket matching Bridge Guy's and a bullet inside of a Hope box, the same brand and caliber as the cartridge found at the crime scene. McClellan called it the Bridge Guy starter kit.
But forensic evidence was just one part. The prosecution also pointed to numerous jailhouse confessions, captured during calls with his mother and wife, as well as statements to mental health professionals. McClellan reminded the jury, Richard Allen told them he killed the girls. He wanted to apologize to their families.
And perhaps the most damning moment? The testimony of Master Trooper Brian Harshman, who analyzed hundreds of calls made by Allen in prison. He stated that the voice from the Bridge Guy video matched Richard Allen's.
McClellan left the jury with a grim picture. Allen, scared by a van, decided to kill the girls instead of carrying out his original plan. He described how Allen forced him to cross the creek, slit Libby's throat first, and left behind crucial evidence, his bullet and Liberty's phone.
He wrapped up his argument with a powerful statement. Look at all the evidence and issue a guilty verdict on all four counts.
After a recess, the defense took the floor. Attorney Brad Rossi made their case, focusing on four key themes: a broken timeline, bumbling ballistics, false confessions, and a digital forensics.
Rossi wasted no time attacking the prosecution's case, claiming they mishandled the investigation from the start. He pointed out that key witness interviews were lost, a height analysis was never done, and that Allen's 5'5" stature didn't match descriptions of the Bridge Guy.
He also highlighted inconsistencies in witness testimony, particularly Betsy Blair, who originally described Bridge Guy as boyish and youthful, words that don't match Richard Allen.
Then came the timeline issues. The defense argued that the state ignored evidence that didn't fit their narrative. Rossi even accused them of withholding a third phone call from Allen in Westville, saying, why not tell the whole story?
And let's talk about the so-called magic bullet. The defense ripped apart the prosecution's forensic evidence, calling it subjective and lacking proper documentation. Rossi asked, where in the hell are the sufficient agreements and marks that match?
He wasn't done. He slammed the confessions, arguing they were false, made under extreme psychological distress after 13 months of solitary confinement. He pointed out that the video footage showed Allen completely disoriented on the same day he allegedly made a confession.
The defense also focused on digital evidence, specifically the claim that someone used Liberty's phone hours after she was murdered. The state disputed this, but Rossi insisted it raised serious doubts.
And then came their final blow, the overwhelming lack of physical evidence tying Allen to the murders. No fingerprints, no DNA, no digital connections, no eyewitnesses positively identifying him.
Rossi closed with a dramatic comparison, showing an image of a medieval torture rack and calling solitary confinement its modern equivalent. He urged the jury to set Richard Allen free.
And then, just like that, the prosecution returned for their final rebuttal. McClellan used his last 10 minutes to remind the jury, Bridge Guy killed Abby and Libby, and Bridge Guy is Richard Allen.
He dismissed the defense's claims as weak, reminding the jury that Allen's own words, his confessions, spoke louder than anything. And he ended with a powerful tribute to the girls, calling them heroes for recording that crucial evidence and leading investigators to their killer.
And with that, the case is now in the hands of the jury, and the fate of Richard Allen would soon be decided.
After about 2 hours of deliberation, the jury has called it a night. They'll be back at 9 a.m. to continue deliberations in the case against Richard Allen. The jury will have to consider 4 counts, 2 counts of felony murder and 2 counts of murder. On the felony counts, they will have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Richard Allen killed Abby and Libby while committing or attempting to commit kidnapping. Count 3 and 4, they'll have to determine if Richard Allen knowingly or intentionally killed Abby and Libby. The burden is on the state, and they must prove each element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury was instructed that if they believe there is a possibility that Richard Allen is not guilty, they must give him the benefit of the doubt and find him not guilty. The jurors must all agree. The prosecution told the jury during closing arguments that if they would determine who Bridge Guy was, they know who killed Abby and Libby. They said that bridge guy is Richard Allen. The defense closed by saying this case is really about four things: a broken timeline, bumbling ballistics, false confessions, and digital forensics. They reiterated to the jury, there's no DNA, fingerprints, digital data, forensics evidence, or trace materials connecting Richard Allen to the crime or to Abby and Libby. They say all of those things make it virtually impossible for Richard Allen to have committed this crime. They asked the jury to set Richard Allen free and enter a verdict of not guilty. The jury will now have to decide Richard Allen's fate. They'll reconvene tomorrow morning starting at 9 a.m.
Days 19 and 20 were spent with the jury focusing on their deliberations. But on Monday, November 11th, a verdict was finally reached. Richard Allen has been found guilty of the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German.
A verdict that comes nearly 7 years after the two teens disappeared near the Monongah Bridge in Delphi, Indiana. They were last seen on the afternoon of February 13, 2017, and their bodies were discovered the following day, not far from where they were last spotted.
Abby was just 13 years old, Libby 14. It was just a day off from school, an unseasonably warm afternoon, and just two friends out for a walk. No one could have imagined the horror that awaited them.
After years of investigation, hearings, and trial proceedings, the jury has made its decision. Richard Allen remained emotionless as the guilty verdict was read, his wife Kathy visibly shaken, unable to stand as the moment unfolded.
The families of Abby and Libby, however, were overcome with emotion. Some were in tears, others relieved. A single word, yes, was heard in the courtroom when the first guilty verdict was announced.
The jury had been deliberating since Thursday, working through Friday and Saturday before returning Monday morning to finalize their decision. And with that, Richard Allen, now 52 years old, will await sentencing on December 20th.
The gag order remains in place, meaning family members and attorneys are still unable to discuss the details of the case publicly at this point. But what we do know is that the state presented 42 witnesses building their case against Richard Allen.
One of the most pivotal pieces of evidence, the video taken by Liberty German on her phone, capturing the infamous bridge guy. Investigators spent years analyzing both the visuals and audio from that clip.
Brian Harshman, a master trooper with the Indiana State Police, testified that after listening to hundreds of phone calls made by Allen from prison, he was convinced Allen's voice matched the voice on the video.
Other witnesses, however, weren't as certain. The chilling phrase, "guys, down the hill," became a part of the trial, but opinions varied on whether it could definitively be linked to Allen.
But perhaps the most damning testimony came from Dr. Monica Walla, a clinical psychologist who interacted with Allen extensively at Westville Correctional Facility. She stated that he confessed to killing the girls multiple times.
She even recounted Allen mentioning an incident from his past, an admission that he may have molested his sister when they were children. But when his sister Jamie Jones took the stand, she denied it had ever happened.
Beyond psychological testimony, forensic evidence played a crucial role. Forensic metallurgy expert Melissa Oberg testified about the .40 caliber unspent cartridge found near the crime scene, saying it had been cycled through Allen's Sig Sauer pistol.
The defense fought hard to discredit this. Dr. Eric Warren, a forensic examiner, argued that the evidence wasn't conclusive. He stated that comparing a spent shell casing to an unspent round was problematic, and that Dr. Oberg's findings were not definitive.
And despite these efforts, the jury sided with the prosecution. The defense called 22 witnesses, but wrapped up their case quickly. Allen himself never took the stand.
The 12 jurors, chosen from Allen County, Indiana, were sequestered throughout the trial. They remained isolated, focused solely on the case, and now their verdict is final.
And on Friday, December 20th, 2024, the final chapter in the Richard Allen trial took place. Judge Fran Gall handed down the maximum sentence, 130 years in prison.
That's 65 years for the murder of Abigail Williams and 65 years for the murder of Liberty German, served consecutively. With credit for time already served, he has 786 days accounted for, but the road ahead of him is clear. He will likely spend the rest of his life behind bars.
And Judge Gall didn't mince words. From the bench, she declared that in her 27 years on the bench, Allen's crimes rank right up there in terms of their heinous nature and the devastating impact that they left on the community.
Six victim impact statements were read in court. Family members spoke about the unimaginable loss, the future stolen from them, the emptiness left behind. The pain of their words were evident.
Judge Goel made several key rulings today. She vacated the felony murder charges, assigned Allen a public defender for his appeals, and lifted the gag order, meaning families and attorneys can now speak about the case.
The defense tried to argue for a lesser sentence, citing Allen's lack of prior criminal history and his mental health struggles, but Judge Goel dismissed these points, saying that the nature of the crimes far outweighed any mitigating circumstances.
And with that, justice has been served nearly 7 years after the tragic February day. Abby and Libby's families finally have the closure they've been seeking.
A case that shook the small town of Delphi, one that captivated the nation, has reached its conclusion. But the memory of Abby and Libby will live on.
Rest in peace, Abby and Libby. And for all of you out there, stay safe.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.